From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, the story of a family reunited for a final goodbye.
I heard someone ring the doorbell. I opened it and it was my mom. And I was like, what? I don't know. I was so surprised.
9 years ago, the De La Rosa family was divided by immigration law. Now, the government is giving them 30 days to be together, to say a final goodbye to a dying husband and father.
My dad always wanted to see us together again. So then, when he did, he died the day after. You know, he lived his best day.
Plus, my interview with Ruben Blades. The 17-time Grammy winner sits down to talk about his decades-long career and his evolution as an artist.
It's just that I went wherever I felt that I could enjoy and produce something.
All this coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri is going to take it from here.
Last August, Arsenio de la Rosa had to be rushed to the hospital. His health had been worsening this year, and he ended up suffering a second stroke at the hospital. Doctors said Arsenio had only weeks to live. Three of his kids, Jim, Naomi, and Bobby, were with him in Tucson when this happened. His 24-year-old son, Bill, scrambled to get a flight home from England, where he's studying at Oxford. And as he flew over the Atlantic Ocean, he wasn't only worrying about the fact that his dad was dying. He was figuring out what it would take to bring their mom to the U.S. so she could say goodbye to her dying husband.
My dad is on the verge of death. I mean, the very least they could do is just allow her to be with him during those last few months.
See, the dad and all four kids in the De La Rosa family are U.S. citizens, but Gloria, the mom, is not. She lives an hour south, just across the U.S.-Mexico border in Nogales, Sonora. We'll get to her story in a second, but for now, what you need to know is that she can't enter the U.S. legally. So when Bill got to Tucson, he quickly gathered all the paperwork necessary to apply for something called humanitarian parole. That's a special permit that the federal government sparingly grants to people who need to come into the U.S. for a few days because of an extreme circumstance, such as the death of a spouse or a child. So Bill drove south, crossed into Mexico, wearing a button-down shirt and dress shoes, and took his mom to the official port of entry in Nogales to make the request with U.S. customs agents.
We walked in there around 1:30, 1:15. We were there until about 5:30. The officer said that, regrettably, they weren't approving my mom's case.
So the request was denied. Bill says his mom started crying, but she made sure to thank the officer for his time as they were escorted out of the interview rooms right back into Mexico. But Bill didn't take no for an answer.
I was pushed to my limit, and I couldn't stand the thought of my mom being in Nogales, stranded, you know, alone. I was just pissed off.
He went back to Tucson and organized a campaign asking the government to reconsider. He reached out to local and national media.
Rogando al gobierno que reconsidere el perdón humanitario
over immigration and approve the few days she needs.
In those couple days, he also got more than 16,000 signatures on a change.org petition. He contacted his local congressman, Democratic Representative Raul Grijalva, who set up a press conference.
Bill and his family are asking for is a sliver of compassion and humanitarian.
Then, in an unexpected turn of events, 3 days after the denial, U.S. immigration officials had a change of heart. They granted Gloria a 30-day permit, an unprecedented amount of time for humanitarian parole of this kind. This meant that after 9 years of being separated because of immigration laws, this family would have 30 days to be together again through a very difficult time.
Today on our show, the 30 days. The De La Rosa siblings are among the 4.5 million kids born in the United States who are U.S. citizens, but who have at least one parent who's undocumented. And often, these so-called mixed-status families end up being separated. And this deeply affects the lives of these American citizen children. Today, we're going to hear the portrait of a family 9 years after they were separated from their mom. And now they're finding themselves brought together by tragedy, but only for 30 days. Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri is going to bring us their story. She worked in collaboration with reporter Perla Treviso of the Arizona Daily Star. You'll hear Perla's voice in the tape from time to time, and Fernanda is going to take it from here.
Let me explain how the De La Rosa family came to be separated in the first place. Arsenio and Gloria got married 27 years ago. They had 4 kids, 3 boys, 1 girl, all U.S. citizens. They lived in Tucson, Arizona most of their lives, going to Mexico from time to time. The only one in the family who wasn't a U.S. citizen was Gloria, who first came here with a tourist visa and ended up staying without documents. Her lack of legal status was something that the family thought they'd fix eventually. And after a few failed attempts, a lawyer advised Gloria to leave the U.S. and go to the consulate in Juarez, Mexico, to petition to be sponsored by her husband. With 4 U.S. citizen kids and a U.S. citizen husband, the lawyer told her it should be a slam dunk. So in October of 2009, Gloria and Arsenio left the U.S. voluntarily and went to Juarez, Mexico, to what they thought would be a simple appointment with immigration officials who would grant her a green card. Instead, she was told that despite not having a criminal record, not only was she not getting a green card, but she was not allowed to enter the U.S. or even apply to come back to the U.S. for 10 years. The 10-year ban shattered the De La Rosa family. Gloria stuck in Mexico, and Arsenio, already in his 70s by then, would have to care for the family alone in the U.S. They decided it would be best for the kids if they continued their education in the U.S., with Gloria living an hour south across the border in Nogales, Sonora, and the family visiting whenever they could. The separation was hard, at times unbearable. But despite all odds, the De La Rosa kids managed to get by with help from teachers, church members, other family members, and especially each other. And that's clear today, as the 4 kids, Jim, Bill, Naomi, and Bobby, prepared to have their mom home for 30 days. Jim is the oldest. He's 26 now. He enlisted in the military right after high school, but after 4 years as a decorated U.S. Marine, he left the military to help take care of his dad and help around the house. You won't hear directly from him in the story, but on the day that Gloria got the permit, he posted a status on Facebook that said, quote, "It went from 5 days to 0 days to now 30 days. I'm gonna eat good for a month. Hashtag mama's cooking." Bill, the second oldest, got in the car as soon as he found out his mom was getting in and drove back to Nogales to pick her up. Bill is 24, tall, clean-cut, with black thick-frame glasses, and he's the doer, the helper, the super smart kid with a full-ride scholarship to Oxford where he's getting a master's. He's the one that took Gloria to the port of entry to get her fingerprints, finished the paperwork, and then walked out with her as they crossed into the U.S., a country that she hasn't lived in for 9 years. Meanwhile, in Tucson, the third sibling, then 17-year-old Naomi, was in her dorm. She knew Bill had been working hard at trying to get his mom's permit, but things happened so fast that she hadn't heard the news that morning.
This lady, she messaged me. She was like, "Congratulations on your mom." And I was like, "What?" So I went on Facebook and I saw all this stuff. I was like, "What the heck?" And like, I started crying. I was like, "What's going on? Oh my God." And like, I was texting Bill. I was blowing up his phone, but he didn't answer me. And like, I was just so confused. So I called Jim. I was like, "What's going on?" He's like, "My mom's coming home. So I need you to come home and clean the house." And I was like, "Okay."
Cleaning the house was nothing new for Naomi. After her mom left 9 years ago, she took on much of the housework and became the surrogate mom of the house, despite being only in third grade. She also took on the mom role for little Bobby, warming up milk for him every night as she tucked him in. And now, Naomi had just recently started school at the University of Arizona. But with her father in the hospital, she had been spending little time at her new dorm. Bobby, the youngest, was at school. He's 13, in 8th grade, and growing fast. He's slowly becoming the tallest in the family, despite still having a baby face.
On that day, during one of his classes, he heard the principal wanted to talk to him. At first, he thought maybe he was in trouble, but instead, the principal showed him a photo online of Gloria surrounded by cameras. His mom was allowed in. This all happened while Bill was driving Gloria from the border up to Tucson. And before even stopping by the house, Bill drove his mom straight to Bobby's school so she could pick him up. Something Gloria hadn't been able to do ever, because the last time she lived there, Bobby was 4. So when Bobby saw his mom outside of his school, they embraced. Mi niño, my boy, she said. Here's Bobby right after it happened.
I mean, that's never happened. She's never come to pick me up from school, so it was different. It was something I've never felt before.
Can you describe that feeling?
Like, nervous? I don't know. I was mostly nervous and excited than anything else.
Then they got in the car and headed home, where Naomi was waiting.
I heard someone ring the doorbell. I opened it, and it was my mom. And I was like, what? I don't know. I was so surprised. Oh, my God. I jumped on her. Like, because I remember when I was small, when was it, third grade? My mom would bring tamales and stuff to class, and I'll be like, Mama. And, like, I would run and, like, jump on her. So that's what I did. So, yeah, I was like, yes.
After picking up Bobby from school and going home to Naomi, it was time for Gloria to go to the hospital to see her husband of almost 3 decades in his last moments of life.
Soy Gloria, vine a verte. Aquí estoy.
She sits by his side on the bed and starts talking to him.
Cheno.
But Arsenio doesn't respond. He can't hear me, she tells Bill. Gloria holds up Arsenio's frail hand and presses hers against his.
¿Quién soy yo?
Do you know who I am? Bill says. It's me, Billy. I'm here with Bobby and with Mom. And for 1 second, Arsenio seems to react. He moves his hand just a little bit. Gloria tells him that she came to see him, to take care of him so he can get better.
Mi mami llegó ahora.
Aquí está mami, vine a verte porque...
That night, Gloria came home to a house that hasn't been her home in almost a decade. And she admits it felt a little weird at first.
9 años es mucho, son 9 años y te acostumbras.
9 years is a long time, she says. You get used to a certain life rhythm.
A un ritmo. Y te acostumbras a un solo lugar.
The kitchen itself is a bit foreign to Gloria now. She has to open up a few cabinets before she knows where to find stuff. And when she asked Jim about an old cooking pot she used to have in the kitchen, he told her, forget about it, Mom. How can you think that things are going to be where you left them 9 years ago? Jim told her. How could you think things are going to be the same? Throughout the years, they've all said that they miss their mom's cooking. And Naomi has learned some recipes from Gloria. But really, it's been Naomi's cooking that they're used to now. And for Naomi, having her mom back in the kitchen is a bit disorienting.
Feels so weird for her to, like, have the household duties of, like, washing dishes and doing my laundry. It's like, I'm 18, Mom. I can do this myself.
Is it I'm 18, Mom? Or is it more like, Mom, this is my house.
It's more like,
which one is it?
Because it's more like, I've been doing this like since I was 9. So it's like, I'm used to this and like, that's my role.
It's day 3 of Gloria's permit, Naomi's 18th birthday. But with Arsenio in the hospital, there's no cake, no candles. Over the following week, the family spent time with Arsenio at the hospital. And on the 12th day of Gloria's permit, Arsenio died. Bobby had hopes that in these 30 days, maybe his dad would get better.
The last time I visited him before he passed away, I told myself that he was going to get through it, and then he just passed away. So it was hard. He always tried to, like, be strong. And so, yeah, I thought he was going to get through it.
The Cobbler, have you seen that movie? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it's, like, about this dude who grants his mom's last wish. And the movie, he says, everyone lives their best day of their life before they die.
I remember that scene specifically because my dad always wanted to see us together again. So then when he did, he died the day after. So I was like, oh, you know, he lived his best day. And his wish was granted and my mom was here.
It's Saturday morning, day 14 of Gloria's permit, the morning of the funeral. The priest held a traditional Catholic mass in Spanish. First, Arsenio's oldest son from a previous marriage spoke, and then it was Bill's turn.
My remarks are in Spanish, and before I begin, I want to extend a welcome and a dear thanks to everyone who is here.
Bill got up on the podium, and in true Bill fashion, was stoic and calm. He has taken on so much ever since he was in high school when the family was separated. He worked odd jobs to make money and help supplement the income that Gloria used to bring home from cleaning hotel rooms. Bill volunteered across town and built a web of support for the family over the years. Ever since we were young, Bill said, our dad taught us respect and to work hard. He told us, if you're going to be a shoemaker, I just want you to be the best shoemaker you can be. Bill's eulogy was thoughtfully worded, like an essay. The people in the pews probably expected nothing less than perfect from Bill. He has to live up to that expectation of keeping his cool no matter what and figuring it all out for the family, even if it means not sleeping and overstressing sometimes. Bill says he feels like he can't let himself fall apart, because if he does that, everyone else will fall apart with him. After the service, the gathering moved to a room in the church for pan dulce and coffee. There were some tears, some laughs, and a lot of reunions with people Gloria hadn't seen in almost a decade. Seeing this all happen, watching Gloria and Bobby hug, watching Naomi lean her head on her mom, it's hard to imagine the De La Rosa siblings going through this without their mom. Gloria has 15 days left until she has to go back to Mexico. And there's one looming task at hand before she leaves, figuring out who will get legal custody of Bobby. He's 13, and with his dad gone and his mom heading back to Mexico soon, he needs a legal guardian.
Coming up on Latino USA, the last 15 days of Gloria's stay. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And before the break, the De La Rosa family held an emotional funeral service for Arsenio. Now, with Gloria at the halfway point of her 30-day permit to be in the United States, Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri picks back up the story.
It's a Sunday afternoon, and the family is spending time at home. It's day 15 of Gloria's permit. There's a huge pot of pozole on the stove that someone brought over for the family to eat all day. They're all chatting and hanging out in the kitchen, sharing stories of when they were little and how they used to prank each other.
Y es lo primero que, que vi, y salí corriendo para el otro lado.
The whole family seems to be taking it all in. This moment of laughter and levity. A family just spending time together, starting to heal after Arsenio's death. After hanging out at the kitchen table, Gloria starts doing the dishes, and Naomi comes up behind her. She leans on the counter, bats her eyelashes, and with a huge smile on her face, she asks her mom to make tamales. Naomi says she'll buy all the ingredients as long as her mom makes them. Naomi says today felt like Christmas because everyone was hanging out at the house. And for many Mexican families, tamales are something you eat around Christmas.
Christmas in September.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gloria has only really spent time with her kids in her small apartment in Nogales, where they visit her a couple times a month. And although she calls them almost every day, she doesn't really know their morning routines, and they don't know hers. At one point, Bill starts telling everyone at the table, half-jokingly, how annoying it is to be woken up at the crack of dawn by Gloria. Bill has been sleeping in the living room on the couch and says that when his mom wakes up, she starts cleaning and cooking and making lots of noise, and she walks around with her cell phone playing loud music. It's not music, she says. It's religious songs, so you can all wake up energized. Bill just shakes his head and laughs. Yes, they're all laughing about this. But there's a little truth behind every joke. And everyone in the family, in their own ways, has felt a combination of happy and a little strange. Happy that they're able to have Gloria at the house, but weird to see her there when they wake up or when they come home in the afternoon. When Bobby hears that his mom might be visiting his school later that week, he gets a little bit frazzled.
So it's like weird because like in middle school, everyone's like all like judgy and stuff. And I just don't want them to. You know, it's weird because my mom has never really been around me. And I think everyone knows that. So if they see her, it's going to be like, it's going to be weird. I don't know.
You think it's just going to be more questions than what you want to deal with?
I mean, if I want her to meet her, but just not when everyone's there.
And for Naomi, she got through middle school and high school without her mom ever visiting her school. She was in third grade when the family was separated.
We withdrew from the Paris Agreement. You can take the elevator now.
She said there's no elevator.
It's day 17 for Gloria, and Bill drove her to the U of A to see Naomi's dorm. Gloria had stopped by on her first couple of days there, but she says she was in such a daze worrying about her husband's health that she barely remembers what it looked like. It's so tiny, Gloria says when she walks in. Bill explains to her that because Naomi has a scholarship, she's not paying for the fancy dorms, and some of the nicer ones that are covered by the scholarships got filled up first. Gloria starts opening drawers and pointing out places where she thinks Naomi should clean more, and Naomi quickly tells her that she hasn't really been spending much time in the dorms because she's been at home since her dad's been in the hospital.
I haven't even been here.
Then Gloria and Bill get on Naomi's case about her lack of decorations when her roommate has tons of pictures stuck on the walls and Naomi has nothing.
What was it like having your mom in your dorm today?
Oh my goodness. Her going through my drawers and saying that I need decorations and stuff. Oh my gosh. She knows I don't like decorations.
And that's the thing. These are the types of interactions that none of us liked growing up. It's just that for this family, it's kind of new. It's been almost a decade since they had their mom at home every day, chasing them around about routine stuff. And as the only girl, Naomi's relationship with her mom is different than the boys. And speaking of the guys, there's a voice missing from this story. Jim, the 26-year-old former Marine and oldest of the four, and that's because he didn't want to be interviewed. He politely told us that he'd think about it, but in the end, he said he'd rather not. And we get it. He doesn't have to talk to us, especially during this incredibly difficult time. But we would have liked to hear from Jim because he is an integral part of this family. He had been the primary caretaker for his father as he got older and his health deteriorated. Day in, day out, Jim bathed him, fed him, and gave him his medications. Jim spent a lot of time at home over the last few years. He had hoped to make a career out of the military, but he essentially put much of his own life on hold for the sake of the family. And now, with his dad gone and Naomi at the dorms, Jim's day-to-day will change significantly. And Jim doesn't seem to want to talk about this much, even with his family. Bill says that he went to dinner with Jim, just the two of them, but the conversation ended up being just about the family logistics.
Not in the sense of like a heart-to-heart. It's more of a sense of like, all right, this is what we have to do. Let's do it. Like, how are we going to cooperate so to get this done? I don't know how Jim processes things. I'm sure he thinks about all of these things behind closed doors.
Jim, as the oldest and the only one living at home full-time, seems like the obvious choice to take on Bobby's guardianship. But when the conversation comes up, there's a bit of tension in the air. Not just because of the bureaucracy of getting it done, but because they're deciding on who should be the one making sure everything is going well with Bobby.
Hi, who am I speaking with? Hi, Carney. My name is Bill. I'm calling on behalf of my mom. She doesn't speak English.
So Bill does what Bill has always done. He starts making phone calls, looking up stuff on the internet, reaching out to people who might know how to go about changing the guardianship of Bobby.
Yeah, do you have any advice on like how we can proceed?
Bill is going back to England to start his semester at Oxford a few days before Gloria's 30 days are up. So there's even more pressure to get Bobby's custody figured out soon.
Mom is here. Are the $204, does that cover the public notary?
Thank you. Alrighty.
They decided it would be joint custody between Jim and Naomi. Jim will be the one living at home with Bobby, but Naomi is really the one closest to Bobby. He trusts her. He tells her what's going on with him.
It feels like, oh my God, it's so cool, but it's a lot of responsibility. But I feel like it's going to help me when I become a teacher. That part of my life is going to help me in the future, because I'm gonna know how to deal with Bobby and like take him to appointments and know how to talk to other grown-ups. So I think it's good.
There's a lot of change happening for Bobby right now. His dad just died. His mom is suddenly home with him, but only for 30 days. His sister Naomi, with whom he shared a bed for most of his childhood, his version of a mom at home for the last 9 years, she's living in the dorms now. All of this as he enters adolescence. At an age that is so impressionable, where we need so much guidance.
You know, Bob is only 13. And Naomi now in the university. So Bob is going to be here pretty much alone.
That's Arsenio Jr., the oldest son from Arsenio's first marriage.
And yeah, it worries me. It worries me a lot. So I'll be talking to Jim as well to take care of them, to be careful, to be there.
He's in his late 50s. He has lived in Southeast Asia for the last 2 decades working as a pilot for a commercial airline, but came for the funeral. And despite being geographically far from his half-siblings, he talks to them often, visits them from time to time, and has helped them out in any way he can, including financially over the years.
This is my family. We want to have things done.
Arsenio Jr.'s concerns are eased a bit after Bill tells him that he got Bobby into an after-school/job thing where he can help take care of dogs that are therapy dogs. It's right up Bobby's alley, since he wants to grow up to be a veterinarian. They want to make sure that he's not just spending all of his time at home playing video games. And Bobby does play a lot of video games. His favorite games are the ones where he can virtually connect with his friends.
Most of my friends are good. And, like, we have this friend named Manny, and, like, he's really bad at it. So we make fun of him, and it's just, like, really funny.
So it's like his real friends at school spend time together after school in video game land, talking to each other through a headset while they play.
I think my mom and Bill and Jim just really think that I just want to play video games, but I think I just play them because, like, my friends talk to me through there. And it's, like, they're, like really close to me. Like, I think, like, they're, like, basically, like, my family. Yeah, and so, like, if I really, really need to tell something to someone, he's there. And he, like, cried when my dad died and everything, so.
He says his friends know what's going on in his life. They don't quite get it, but they listen. And whether it's video games or movies or friends, the De La Rosa siblings all find ways to cope with what's been going on. For Bill, the one that has sort of taken on the decision-making role in the house, it's staying busy.
What's therapeutic for me is helping my siblings. When I, and my mom, right? So when I help them, that I think that's mentally, emotionally beneficial for me.
But there is one thing they all do.
I cry a lot, but just not in front of them. I don't know. I think it's just like a self-defense mechanism that happens.
They put on a strong front when they're together and save their tears for when they're alone. Even the youngest in the family, Bobby, does that.
Naomi was telling us how she wants to be really strong for you. Bill is telling us he wants to be strong for Naomi and you. And do you feel like you also have to do that a little bit?
I think it's like Jim and my dad have showed me that a lot because, like, I know Jim's, like, sad and stuff, but, like, he doesn't really show it. And I feel like that makes him, like, really strong because I know it's hard. And I think I just, like, look up to Jim in that way. And then my dad, I looked up to him like that, too.
They do this strong thing for themselves, but also for each other.
I don't really want to, like, remind Bobby because I don't want him to cry and stuff. And I want him to focus on school, especially because he's been missing so many days. So I try not to bring that up. Because last night I started listening to Michael Jackson and Selena and stuff. And, like, I was in my feelings, so I started crying. So I went outside. And my mom was sleeping and stuff, so I was like, ugh. That's a good time.
Why is that a good time to cry?
Because I don't like when people see me cry. I don't know. I just don't like it. Other than like my nose turning red and all big and puffy. I don't like when people see me cry.
It's September 24th. Day 30th of Gloria's permit. Her time in the U.S. has expired, and this is the last time she'll wake up in her Tucson home. Jim drove Gloria, Bobby, and Naomi an hour south to the border, and when they got there, Gloria said she was there to turn in her permit. She hugged her kids goodbye, and then she crossed into Mexico, walking a few blocks to her little apartment. I feel empty, like the most important part of my life stayed there in Tucson, Gloria says. She had gotten used to being with her kids in the morning, cooking them breakfast and sending them off with a blessing every day. Now, she'll go back to cooking for one and spending her free time with the friends she's made at church over the years. And just like her kids, she holds her tears until she's alone. I didn't want to cry in front of the kids, she says. I didn't want them to feel worse seeing me cry. A week after Gloria had to go back to Mexico, we called Bill in England and Naomi in Tucson.
Naomi?
Hi.
Is this still a good time?
They're still trying to process and mourn the death of their father.
I just wanted to see how you were feeling.
After talking to them, it was clear that this time together as a family in Tucson again did two things. It brought them closer together, but it also highlighted their differences.
It does highlight like how much time has passed, right, since my mom was originally barred.
At the same time, it allowed them to be kids again.
The childhood that I missed out on, Bobby was just like, he was being a little kid again. Like, the atmosphere was happy.
These 9 years apart have forced the De La Rosa kids and their mom to build parallel lives. They're so close, an hour apart across an international border, yet in two different worlds. All because of that trip to Ciudad Juarez in 2009, when they had every intention of getting her green card the quote-unquote right way. Despite the damage caused by the separation, they figured out how to succeed, each of them in their own way. But it hasn't been easy. They've had to learn that when you start to drown and the world is overwhelming, you'll survive if you just hold your breath just a little longer. Close your eyes and hold back the tears until the water settles.
Our thanks to Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri. Gloria has one more year left in her 10-year ban. By October of 2019, she'll be able to apply to come into the United States again, this time with her children as her sponsors, not her husband. So, as they say in Mexico, no es un adiós, sino un hasta luego. It's not goodbye. It's until next time. This story was produced in collaboration with Perla Treviso of the Arizona Daily Star. Go to our website, latinousa.org, to see our collaborative multimedia story, which includes photos and the story from the Daily Star. Fernanda and Perla's original multimedia documentary about the De La Rosa family in 2015 is titled Divided by Law. It was a production of Arizona Public Media and the Arizona Daily Star. You can find it at dividedbylaw.com. Coming up on Latino USA, we talk to one of the most influential and prolific Latin recording artists of our time. A conversation with Rubén Blades. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland and Northeast Ohio more globally competitive, livable, sustainable, and just. More information available at gundfoundation.org. And Americans for the Arts, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education, supporting the nonprofit arts industry, which employs 4.6 million people nationwide. Learn more at AmericansfortheArts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Rubén Blades is one of the most prolific Latin recording artists alive. The 17 Grammy winner made his name with Fania Records in the 1970s, bringing a new kind of storytelling to salsa and Latin jazz. But where some artists might have stayed put, Rubén continued to wander and experiment over his decades-long career. Rubén Blades has collaborated with artists like Lou Reed and Sting, all the way to Calle 13 and Wynton Marsalis. Most recently, he's released an album called Una Noche con Rubén Blades, A Night with Rubén Blades. It's a big band live recording featuring the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra in New York City. Rubén Blades, welcome to Latino USA.
Muchas gracias.
I got to tell you, of course, I was a Latina in New York City in college, and your music was like literally the album of our lives.
Gracias.
Your music then, it was not just about dancing, as we know.
Well, the thing basically is that I thought there were people who were writing about love much better than I could. I do feel there is a need to write about what is happening around us. Well, I don't believe in political art. That's like an oxymoron.
Like propaganda.
Exactly. That's what it turns into. I resent the fact that anybody would ever call me a political singer, because I'm not. But I do believe that one can document what's going on around us and that somehow that will make us all feel less alone, less disconnected.
So you arrive in New York City.
74.
In 74.
The first time was 69.
To visit.
The dictatorship closed the university and I was studying law school. And my mother was very worried that I was going to probably join some art movement.
Seriously?
Yeah. Entonces, my mother knew that I loved music, but I had decided I'm going to go into law school only because the dean of the law school also, he said, you're going to be a lawyer or a musician. You can't be both here, you know, so you got to decide. And I decided for law. But then the army closed the school. My mother proposed out of nowhere this woman who did not want me to be a musician. She proposed for me to go to New York and visit New York that I always talked about in New York. And you can see musicians in New York. And I'm looking at her like, is she drunk? You know, it's like, and it didn't dawn on me what she was doing. I was so happy. I said, oh, sure. And my mother gave me some money that she had. And I had a promise done earlier, 67, I think, by Pancho Cristal, who was a huge producer here in New York. And he said, oh, I can do an album for you. So when I found out that I was going to New York with the blessing of my mom, I called him and I did my recording. That was my first album, De Panamá Nueva York, with Pete Rodriguez and the Boogaloo Pete and his orchestra, the guy from I Like It Like That and all that. And then I went back to Panama, university open again. And then when I finished law school, my family had left in 73 because of the military. I stayed behind because I was working with my thesis was on repeat criminals. And once I finished, I left a week later. I went to Florida where they were. I stayed with them for a while and feeling useless. I was almost 26 at the time. My diploma meant nothing there. And I didn't know what to do to work. I didn't have any papers. That's why I called Fania Records in New York.
Like, literally, you're like, hey.
The biggest label in the world in salsa.
I'm just going to call you guys? No, you had an agent who.
No. I had nothing.
So, like, seriously, you're like,
I just pick up the phone and try to find what Fania number was in New York and then called. And I said, you know, once I wrote a song for Richie Ray in 1969, that was Guaguancó Triste, I believe it was. It went well, and then I wrote something for Imael Miranda, you know, so wouldn't you want me to go there and write for you? And they said, no. and I said,
no, thank you.
No, we don't need singers, we don't need anything. And I said, well, do you have any job available? And they said, it's a job in the mailroom. And I said, it just opened today, as a matter of fact. Then I said, well, how much does it pay? $125 a week. I said, I'll take it. And I went.
And they just said, okay.
Yeah, I don't know why, but they said, oh, okay.
So you're starting in the mailroom.
In the mailroom of Fania, that's where I started. When I was in Panama, I wrote two songs that were recorded by Fania musicians. So I figured now I'm in the mailroom in Fania, in New York. Of course I'm going to write for more people because I see them when they come to get their checks and whatnot. And that's how I started. I mean, Conjunto Candela recorded a song of mine called María Merced. And Amor Pa' Qué, who was a big hit, huge hit, Amor Pa' Qué with Néstor Sánchez. Amor Pa' Qué, si al fin y al cabo siempre termina. And Imael Miranda.
Like all the greats, man. Like right there next to you.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking now about the heyday of Fania. Mm. New York City.
The 70s were a very important moment because of what was happening in the city as a whole. It wasn't just a salsa movement. It was like you had everything seemed to happen at the same time. You have rock. You had the beginnings of punk. You had the jazz scenes. Where John Lennon was living in the city. Stuff that Eddie Palmieri was doing, Willie Colon, Vietnam.
The protest.
U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War.
You know, the Nixon.
The crime of perjury. Is
the true. Young Lords. And everything seemed to converge at the time. You know, there was an incredibly raw energy all over the place.
What year does Siembra come out?
I think it was recorded in 77, so it's either 77, 78, around there.
You know, the song that comes to mind for me when I think of the album Siembra, it's definitely Plástico. La gente se volvía loca, and everybody was singing that song. I mean, we'd be in house parties, and the floor would be like...
Plástico is a song about consumerism.
Ella era una chica plástica.
You know, people buying things they don't need. Appearances before reality. Fake positions versus the need to confront reality. And it was, for me, exemplified by the whole disco thing at the time, because I have nothing against disco music. I actually like some of it. The thing is that I felt that it was influencing areas of our lives, sort of taking total control. The fact that you had to dress a certain way and do certain things.
Or else you wouldn't even be allowed into the club, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, for one. But the point is, if you notice, it wasn't just about the dancing. I go from the plastic girl to the plastic boy to the plastic couple to the plastic city, which is the progression of that false appreciation of what life is about. And that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to make people aware of the fact that if we didn't get ourselves together and face reality, not just escape all the time. And I felt music is good to escape. Yes, I use it too, but it should not be a vehicle for perpetual escapism.
Right, or for denial.
Or denial. That's why I did that song, Plastic. Yeah, I'm very grateful, not just from the point of vanity, but just in point of solidarity, because I always thought I wanted to prove the fact that audiences are smarter than these people think. They think audiences can't get it. You know, it's too long.
Or we'll reject it.
We'll reject it. I said, you know, no, it's a story. We are storytellers.
Which brings us to the album Maestra Vida.
That's another one that was like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, people were like, oh, wait, he's going to make an opera out of salsa?
No, no, it was worse because after Plástico, then they want you to write a song called Celofán. You know, and after, yeah, you know.
And after Celofán, Styrofoam.
Styrofoam, so, because, you know, you stay there because that clicked. You know, Pedro Navas, so now it's Juan Machete, and then it's like Raúl Revolve. You know, just stay around there. And instead of coming with something, following up this monster hit, I come up with Maestra Vida.
Maestra Vida, camara, te da y te quita y te quita y te da.
I decided I'm going to write a story about a family from the moment they meet to the moment they die in a neighborhood. And this particular imagination place that I created called Hispania, it begins with a classical introduction, you know, an overture, and then it goes into a spoken word. It goes into like a narration, and then there's theater.
Todos los hechos lo condenaban. Las anécdotas y los recuerdos hablaban mal de él. Con los ojos enterrados.
Then all of a sudden the songs begin, and then there's more talk, and then there's a diary that you go to the back and you have to read the album, and then you start following up on the characters, and it made all these demands of an audience that allegedly was there just to escape. And I asked people to write me because I knew that was going to be the way for me to gauge, you know, whether people were supporting, and I got thousands of letters.
You end up recording in English. Mm-hmm. You start recording with Lou Reed.
To believe in someone else.
With Sting. With Elvis Costello.
Bought a ticket to America.
I did an album in English and called Nothing But the Truth. And I said, I want to write with five guys. You know, I want to write with Paul Simon, with Sting, with Bob Dylan, with Lou Reed, and with Elvis Costello. And the guy from A&R, from Elektra, just looked at me like I had just asked him to drink a poison. And he said, Ruben, that's not going to happen. And I said, why not? He said, well, first of all, the five guys you mentioned, they've never collaborated with anyone. The thing is, I insisted. And then he came back about a month later, and I forgotten about it. And he said, you know, they all said yes. But they don't want to talk to us. They want to talk to you. So I actually met with Dylan. He came to the house. And we spent like 5 hours writing supposedly a song, which I still have on a tape recorder.
So you do something again, another Ruben Blades move, which is, okay, I'm actually going to translate Michael Jackson's I Just Can't Stop Loving You. Then, you know, something more modern which happened, which I think everybody was thrilled to hear you with Residente from Calle 13.
Aquí de nada vale tu apellido, tu dinero. Se respeta el carácter de la gente con que andamos.
Nacimos de muchas madres, pero aquí solo hay hermanos. Y ese
mar frente. The question of, you know, Rubén Blades and his evolution of music. And what would you say when people say, like, what's the evolution? It seems to me like you're saying, yo, I'm an artist, and wherever I kind of feel like I need to be.
That's what I do. I mean, right now we're playing, we got an album coming with Wynton Marsalis and the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. We did 3 shows in 2014, and we did songs in Spanish and songs in English. And this is like the utmost, I think it's the best jazz ensemble band in the world. And Wynton is like the trumpeter worldwide. Que a la patria no la define. I mean, to work with them and everybody again was like, what's going to happen? What's going to come out of this? Now we're doing with the band, I'm doing big band stuff. We're doing Tony Bennett standards. We're doing Sinatra standards. One thing leads to another, to make, to run from cover. I give it my own twist. And again, some salsa people will say, like, why is he doing that? You know, and I say, why not? Why not?
Rubén Blades, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA and spending some time with us. And thank you for being the unencumbered artist that you are. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The latest album from Rubén Blades is called Una Noche con Rubén Blades, and it's out on October 19th. Yo que pensaba, hoy no es mi día, estoy sala. Pero Pedro Navaja, tú estás peor, tú estás en nada. Y créanme, gente, que aunque hubo ruido, nadie salió. No hubo curiosos, no hubo preguntas, nadie lloró. Solo un borracho con los dos muertos se tropezó. Cogió el revólver, el puñal, los pesos y se marchó. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Fernanda Chavarri, Antonia Cerejido, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo with help from Maya Cueva. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Mora and Comis Johnson. Special thanks to the Arizona Daily Star, Perla Treviso, and Mike Christie. And a very special thanks to the De La Rosa family for letting us into their lives. Also this week, thanks to Ernesto Lugar. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. And I'll see you there. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. Change for families by families. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Like in a car or something, and you'd hear the cut?
No. I don't drive. I never learned to drive.
Wait, what?
I don't know how to drive.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better, more just society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation. Support.